Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
Professor Fogel is widely recognized for important contributions to economic science that have further led the understanding of long-term technological and institutional change. His early work focused on railroads and economic growth in American history, which was followed by analyses of the economics of American slavery. Since the late 1980s, Fogel's principal research has focused on explaining the secular decline in mortality and the changing pattern of aging over the life cycle of the United States. Fogel earned his BA in 1948 from Cornell University, his MA from Columbia University in 1960, and his PhD in economics from Johns Hopkins University in 1963. Currently, he is the Charles R. Walgren Distinguished Service Professor of American Institutions at the University of Chicago's Graduate School of Business, the director of the Center for Population Economics and co-director of the Program on Cohort Studies at the National Bureau of Economic Research. Professor Fogel is the author of more than 20 books, and his achievements have been recognized with many honors and awards. In 1993, he was the recipient of the Nobel Prize in economics for, quote, having renewed research in economic theory and quantitative methods in order to explain economic and institutional change, close quote. Please join me in welcoming Professor Robert Fogel.
Thank you very much for inviting me to participate in this very distinguished lecture series. The first time I visited Berkeley was in December of 1960, and I've been back here many times and interacted with colleagues in economics, demography, history, and other fields. So, and I've been pleased since I've arrived to see many old friends. The main proposition of my talk today is that the extent and severity of chronic conditions in middle and late ages are to a large extent the outcome of environmental insults at early ages, including in utero. Chronic diseases at middle and late ages are due to a large extent to the toll taken by infectious diseases at young ages. Evidence to support this proposition comes partly from the study being conducted at Chicago and elsewhere on the aging of Union Army veterans, and I'll refer to that study as the Early Indicators Project. But it is also supported by other longitudinal studies in the United States and abroad. Some recent studies indicate two-generation effects among humans. Perhaps the most widely known case involves women who were born or who were in gestation during the Dutch famine, which lasted about 8 or 9 months toward the end of World War II, and was precipitated by sharp reductions in rations. Although this famine resulted in an elevated perinatal death rate, it was for a long time thought that women who survived and were subsequently well-fed were just as healthy as women who were born before the famine or afterwards. However, when these famine women began giving birth, their children had elevated perinatal death rates. Of course, we will still have to wait to see what the effects of the famine will be on the rate of increase in chronic conditions and on longevity at older ages. However, there is evidence that children of mothers who were in the first trimester of gestation when the famine struck and who survived infancy have elevated prevalence of coronary heart disease now that they are in their mid-50s. Environmental conditions were far more severe in 1900 than in recent decades. There are many ways this can be measured. One of them is the infant death rate. And figure one presents some results of an ongoing study of changes and disparities in infant mortality during the 20th century by neighborhoods of the 24 largest U.S. cities in 1900. At the present time, we're using wards averaging about 30,000 people as the unit of observation, but such large wards tend to mask disparities since they tend to combine both rich and poor neighborhoods. We hope eventually to conduct the analysis at the level of census districts, which average about 8,000 individuals and are more homogeneous with respect to socioeconomic status and health conditions than wards. However, even when the analysis is conducted at the ward level, the results are striking, as is shown by figure one. In this figure, the y-axis is the infant death rate, and the x-axis is year. There are three sets of observations. The maximum infant death rate across about 120 wards is shown around the top line. The scatter around the top line represents the infant death rate in the worst wards. The minimum infant death rates are clustered around the bottom line. And the line in the middle represents the average. The main point of this figure is how wide the range in infant death rates were at the beginning of the period. 226 per thousand between the best and the worst wards in 1900. But by 1950, the differential between the best and the worst wards had declined to about 38 per thousand. During the first half of the 20th century, the spread between the best and the worst wards diminished by 83%. Hence, the first point to be noted about changes in disparities in the 20th century is that the range of differences in exposure to disease has narrowed greatly over the course of the century. The disparities we observe today are much smaller than they used to be. From the perspective of 1900, we are currently engaged in fine-tuning, not in gross corrections of disparities. Many examples of how much wider disparities were among ethnic groups can be presented. One example is from a paper by Todd Bridges. The infant death rate from diarrheal diseases during the summer months in Chicago in 1910 for foreign-born mothers was nine times as high as the rate for native-born mothers. I began this talk by focusing on infectious diseases, although my assignment in this paper is the explanation for the decline in chronic diseases, because one of the principal findings of the Early Indicators Project is that insults from infectious diseases at early ages has a large impact on the prevalence rate of chronic diseases and disabilities in middle and late ages. Another major finding of the Early Indicators Project is that age-specific prevalence rates of chronic diseases were much lower at the end of the 20th century than they were at the beginning of the century or during the last half of the 19th century. The Union Army data reveal the ubiquity of chronic health conditions during the century before World War II. Not only was the overall prevalence rate of these diseases much higher among the elderly than today, but they afflicted the teens, young adults, and middle ages to a much greater extent than today. This fact is brought out by Table 1, which shows that more than 80% of all males aged 16 to 19 in 1861 and more than 70% of men aged 20 through 24 were examined for the Union Army. These examinees were overwhelmingly volunteers. Less than 4% were drafted, who presumably thought they were fit enough to serve. Yet disability rates were higher than today. Even among teenagers, 1 out of 6 was disabled, and among men aged 35 to 39, more than half were disabled. Despite their relatively young ages, cardiovascular diseases, mainly rheumatic, accounted for 11% of the rejections, hernias, another 12%, eye, ear, and nose diseases, 7%, tuberculosis and other respiratory diseases, 7%, tooth and gum diseases, 8%. Most of the other rejectees were due to orthopedic conditions or general debility. These findings about the early onset of chronic diseases cast new light on the debate over the effect of increased longevity on the prevalence rates of chronic diseases. Those who argued that the effect of increased longevity was to increase the average duration of chronic disease assumed no delay in the average age of onset of these diseases. They were also influenced by cross-sectional evidence that showed some increase in disability rates during the 1970s and 1980s, despite the continuing decline in mortality rates. It seemed plausible that various health interventions and environmental changes served to reduce the severity of disease and thus delayed death without providing cures, as has been the case with AIDS. However, Table 2 shows there has been a significant delay in the onset of chronic diseases during the course of the 20th century. Men aged 50 through 54 were 24% more likely to be free of chronic conditions in 1994 than a century earlier. At age 60 through 64, white males today are 2.5 times more likely to be free of chronic diseases than their counterparts a century ago. Further light is shed on this issue by considering specific diseases. Table 3 shows that arthritis began 11 years later among men who turned 85. Among men who turned 65 between 1983 and 1992, than those who turned age 65 between 1995 and 1910. The delay in the onset of a chronic condition was about 9 years for heart diseases, about 11 years for respiratory diseases, despite the much higher rates of cigarette smoking, and nearly 8 years for neoplasms. Union Army veterans who endured poor health did not typically die quickly. Veterans who lived to be at least age 50 and who entered the pension system before age 51 lived an average of 24 years past age 50. Moreover, at their last examination, on or before age 51, their average degree of disability was 58%, where 100% indicates complete incapacity from manual labor. Between age 50 and age 60, disability ratings controlled for age of death continued to rise sharply and then increased at a decreasing rate. It is worth noting that for veterans who lived to be age 50, about 29% lived to be age 80 or more. For these old, the level of disability from manual labor averaged between 85 and 100% for a decade or more. Indeed, some survived with such high levels of disability for as much as a quarter of a century. As Table 4 shows, survivors usually acquired more and more comorbidities as they aged. Those who lived past age 85 had twice as many comorbidities as those who died by age 55. Consideration of the sweep of the 20th century puts the debate over the relationship between the increase in life expectancy and the change in the burden of chronic diseases among the elderly in a new perspective. It now appears that the decline in morbidity rates parallel the decline in mortality rates. Indeed, the delay in the onset of chronic disabilities between 1900 and the 1990s for those who lived to be age 50 or more was greater than the increase in life expectancy at age 50 over the same periods. The average delay in the onset of chronic diseases over the century was more than 10 years. However, the average increase in male life expectancy was about 6.6 years. Public health policies before 1940 had a large impact on the decline in chronic disability rates. Decades later, Dora Koster has estimated the impact of public health and socioeconomic status factors at late developmental and young adult ages on risks of incurring chronic conditions at middle and late ages. Significant predictors included mortality rates in counties of enlistment, infectious diseases experienced during the Civil War, and being a prisoner of war. She focused on a set of chronic diseases for which clinical diagnoses were essentially the same in the early 1900s as today, such as lower back pain, joint problems, decreased breath or adventitious sounds, irregular pulse, and valvular heart disease. This procedure permitted her to estimate how much of the observed decline in the prevalence rates of comparable conditions was due to the reduction in specific risk factors. Prevalence rates for 1971-1980 were computed from the National Health and Nutrition Examination Survey, better known by its acronym NHANES. She found that elimination of exposure to specific infectious diseases during developmental and young adult ages explained between 10 and 25% of the decline in specific chronic diseases at middle and late ages between 1900-1910 and 1971-1980. Occupational shifts were also important accounting for 50% of the decline in joint problems, 75% of the decline in back pains, and 25% of the decline in respiratory diseases. Costa pushed this line of analysis further by documenting the decline in functional limitations among men between ages 50 and 74 over the course of the 20th century. A central issue is the factoring of the decline in functional limitations among three processes: the decline in the prevalence rates of specific chronic diseases, the reduction in the debilitating sequelae of these diseases, and the influence of new medical technologies that relieve and control the sequelae. Her analysis turned on five functional limitations: difficulty walking, difficulty bending, paralysis, blindness in at least one eye, and deafness in at least one ear. Prevalence rates of these limitations among men aged 50 to 74 were computed for the Union Army NHANES surveys of 1988 and through 1994 and NHIS surveys over the same dates. On average, these five functional limitations declined by 40% during the course of the 20th century. Using probit regressions, Koster attributed 24% of the decline to the reduction in the debilitating effect of chronic conditions and 37% to the reduced rates of chronic conditions. The contribution of the improvements in body size, as measured by stature, BMI, and other dimensions, has run through the research of the Early Indicators Project like a red line. The discovery of correlations in time series going back to the colonial period between changes in stature and changes in life expectancy for the United States were reported first in 1986, although it was known as early as 1978. Pursuit of a variety of issues called attention to the significant changes in body size to the long-term decline in chronic conditions and mortality. For example, Diane Lauderdale and Paul Rathaus sought to investigate the impact of unhealthy environments on the genetic component of height. They hypothesized that an unhealthy environment might attenuate the effects of genotype. To test that hypothesis, they constructed a sample of brothers who served in the Union Army. Their analysis showed that brothers from unhealthy counties had both higher variances in height and lower covariances in the heights of siblings than was expected from standard equations for measuring genetic influence in heights of siblings. Study of the likelihood of developing specific diseases while in the service also pointed to the importance of stature. For example, short recruits were more likely to develop tuberculosis while in the service than taller ones. In 1995, Costa discovered a sample of 23,000 Union Army recruits who were, for scientific reasons, more intensively examined than the typical recruit. Benjamin A. Gould, a leading astronomer and one of the founders of the National Academy of Sciences, who was in charge of the project, collected information on waist and hip circumference, lifting strength, vital capacity of lungs, height, weight, and shoulder width, and chest circumference. The sample covered whites, blacks, and Native Americans. Costa linked a subsample of 521 white recruits who survived to 1900 to the pension records. She also compared the Union Army soldiers with soldiers measured in 1946, 47, 1950, and 1988. Over a span of 100 years, men in the military became taller and heavier. Their height increased by 5 centimeters, and the BMI of men aged 31 through 35 increased from 23 to 26. Controlling for BMI and age, the waist, hip, and chest shoulder ratios, both measures of abdominal fat, was significantly greater in the Gould sample, that is, the Civil War sample, than in 1950 and the 1988 samples. Using an independent competing risk hazard model to estimate the effect of changes in body shape on the risk of death from cerebrovascular and ischemic heart diseases at earlier ages, she found that a low waist-to-hip ratio increased mortality by 4.4 times relative to the mean, controlling for BMI, while a high waist-to-hip ratio increased mortality risk by 2.9 times. Substituting the characteristics of soldiers in 1950 who reached age 65 or older during the 1980s into her regression produced a 15% decline in all-cause mortality above age 64, implying that changes in frame size explain about 47% of the total decline in all-cause mortality at older ages between the beginning and the end of the 20th century. Recognition of environmentally induced changes in human physiology during the 20th century that had a profound impact on the process of aging did not become apparent to the early indicator investigators until mid-1993. The key finding was that prevalence rates in the main chronic diseases among Union Army veterans aged 65 and older were much higher in 1910 than among veterans of World War II of the same ages during the mid to late 1950s. That finding was first set forth in a 1993 working paper and was elaborated and subsequently characterized as a theory of technophysioevolution. The theory of technophysioevolution arose out of intense debates among the senior investigators, consultants, and research assistants during 1993-1994 with the physicians providing much of the intellectual leadership. This theory points to the existence of a synergism between technological and physiological improvements that has produced a form of human evolution that is biological but not genetic, rapid, culturally transmitted, and not necessarily stable. The process is still ongoing in both rich and developing countries. Unlike the genetic theory of evolution through natural selection, which applies to the whole history of life on Earth, technophysioevolution applies only to the last 300 years of human history, and particularly to the last century. The theory of technophysioevolution rests on the proposition that during the last 300 years, particularly during the 20th century, human beings have gained an unprecedented degree of control over their environment, a degree of control so great that it sets them apart not only from all other species, but also from all previous generations of Homo sapiens. This new degree of control has enabled Homo sapiens to increase their average body size by over 50%, to increase their average longevity by more than 100%, and to greatly improve the robustness and capacity of vital organ systems. Figure 2 helps to point up how dramatic the change in the control of the environment after 1700 has been. During its first 200,000 years or so, Homo sapiens increased at an exceedingly slow rate. This diagram, the y-axis is population, and the x-axis is time. And population goes from 0 to over 6 billion. And time, which has a break in it, goes from about minus 9,000 to plus 2,000. The discovery of agriculture about 11,000 years ago broke the tight constraint on the food supply imposed by a hunting and gathering technology, making it possible to release between 10 and 20% of the labor force from direct production of food, and also giving rise to the first cities. The new technology of food production was so superior to the old one that it was possible to support a much higher rate of population increase. And you can see for the first 200,000 years or so on this diagram, the total world's population was approximately 0. That is, the line more or less hugs the 0 line. Yet, as figure 2 shows, the advances in the technology of food production after the second agricultural revolution, which began about 1700 AD, were far more dramatic than the earlier breakthrough, since they permitted the population to increase at so high a rate that the line of population appears to explode, rising almost vertically. The new technological breakthroughs in manufacturing, transportation, trade, communication, energy production, leisure time services, and medical services were in many respects even more striking than those in agriculture. Figure 2 emphasizes the huge acceleration in both population and technological change during the 20th century. The 20th century begins about there. And I hope you can see the different innovations which are shown, like electrification, the automobile, near the top or dolly, the cloned sheep, and at the very top, stem cell research. The increase in the world's population between 1900 and 1990 was 4 times as great as the increase during the whole previous 200,000 years of humankind. The 20th century contrasts with the record of the two preceding centuries. In every measure that we have on the standard of living, such as real income, homelessness, life expectancy, and height, the gains of the lower classes have been far greater than those experienced by the population as a whole, whose overall standing has also improved. The Gini ratio, which is also called the concentration ratio, is the measure of inequality of the income distribution most widely used by economists. This measure varies between 0, perfect equality, and 1, maximum inequality. Everybody has nothing except for one person. In the case of England, for example, which has the longest series of income distributions, the Gini ratio stood at about 0.65 near the beginning of the 18th century, at about 0.55 near the beginning of the 20th century, and at 0.32 in 1973 when it bottomed out, not only in Britain but also in the United States and other rich nations. This measure indicates that over two-thirds of the reduction in the inequality of income distribution between 1700 and 1773 took place during the 20th century. The large decrease in such inequality, coupled with the rapid increase in average income of the English population, means that the per capita income of the lower classes was rising much more rapidly than those of the middle or upper classes. A similar conclusion is implied by data on life expectancies. For the cohort born around 1875, there was a gap of 17 years between the average length of life of the British elite and of the population as a whole. There is still a social gap in life expectancy among the British, but today the advantage of the richest classes over the rest of the population is only about 4 years. Thus, about three-quarters of the social gap in longevity has disappeared. As a consequence, the life expectancy of the lower classes increased from 41 years at birth in 1875 to 74 years today, while the life expectancy of the elite increased from 58 years at birth to about 78 years. If anything sets the 20th century apart from the past, it is this huge increase in the longevity of the lower classes. Data on stature indicate the high degree of inequality during the 19th century. At the close of the Napoleonic Wars, a typical British male at maturity was about 5 inches shorter than a mature male of upper class birth. There is still a gap in stature between the workers and the elite of Britain, but now the gap is only on the order of an inch. Height differentials by social class have virtually disappeared in Sweden and Norway, but not yet in the United States. Statistical analysis across a wide array of rich and poor countries today shows a strong correlation between stature and the Gini ratio. Weight is another important measure of inequality. Despite the great emphasis in recent years on weight reduction, the world still suffers more from undernutrition and underweight than from overweight, as the World Health Organization has repeatedly pointed out. Although one should not minimize the affliction caused by overnutrition, it is important to recognize that even in rich countries such as the United States, undernutrition remains a significant problem, especially among impoverished pregnant women, children, and among the aged. The secular increase in body builds is due primarily to the great improvement in socioeconomic conditions over the past several centuries, rather than to genetic factors, as can be seen by considering Holland. The average height of young adult males was only about 64 inches in that country during the middle of the 19th century. The corresponding figure today is about 73 inches. An increase of 9 inches in just 4 generations cannot be due to natural selection or genetic drift, because such processes require much longer time spans. Nor can it be attributed to heterosis, hybrid vigor, because Holland's population has remained relatively homogeneous, and because the effect of heterosis in human populations have been shown both empirically and theoretically to have been quite small. It is hard to come up with credible explanations for the rapid increase in heights that do not turn on environmental factors, especially improvements in nutrition and health. These environmental factors appear to be still at work. Stature is still increasing, although at a somewhat lower rate, and nations have not yet reached a mean height that represents the biological limit of humankind under current biomedical technology. Homelessness is another indicator of the dramatic reduction in inequality during the 20th century. Down to the middle of the 19th century, between 10 and 20% of the population in Britain and on the continent were homeless persons, whom officials classified as vagrants and paupers. Estimates of vagrancy and pauper rates in the United States during the United States are less certain, but these rates appear to have reached European levels in the major cities during the middle decades of that century. When we speak of homelessness in the United States today, we are talking about rates between below 0.4% of the population. Many of the homeless today are mentally ill individuals released prematurely from psychiatric institutions that are inadequately funded. Many others are chronically poor and inadequately trained for the current job market. The relatively generous poverty program developed in Britain during the second half of the 18th century and the bitter attacks on that program by Malthus and others have given the unwarranted impression that government transfers played a major role in the secular decline in beggary and homelessness. Despite the relative generosity of English poor relief between 1750 and 1834, beggary and homelessness fluctuated between 10 and 20%. Despite the substantial reduction in the proportion of national income transferred to the poor, as a result of the poor laws of 1834 and later years, homelessness declined sharply during the late 19th and early 20th centuries. The fact is that the government transfers were incapable of solving the problems of beggary and homelessness during the 18th and much of the 19th centuries, because the root cause of the problem was chronic malnutrition. Even during the most generous phases of the relief program, the bottom fifth of the English population was so severely malnourished that it lacked the energy for adequate levels of work. At the end of the 18th century, British agriculture, even when supplemented by imports, was simply not productive enough to provide more than 80% of the potential labor force with enough calories to sustain regular manual labor. It was the huge increase in English productivity during the latter part of the 19th century and the early 20th centuries that made it possible to feed even the poor at relatively high caloric levels. Begging and homelessness were reduced to exceedingly low levels by 19th century standards only when the bottom fifth of the population acquired enough calories to permit regular work. The principal way in which government policy contributed to that achievement was through its public health program. By reducing exposure to disease, more of the calories that the poor ingested were made available for work. Technophysioevolution implies that some theoretical propositions that underlie some current economic models are misspecified because the initial endowments of health capital of successive cohorts increased over the course of the 20th century. The common assumption that the endowment of human physiological capacity is fixed so that medical intervention can only slow down the rate of deterioration in the original endowment means that ways of forecasting future improvements in human physiology are sometimes neglected and possible paths of increase in health endowments play little role in forecasting future healthcare costs or longevity. The theory of technophysioevolution implies that health endowments in a given population change with the year of birth. In other words, you need to have a subscript on the date of creation of the endowment. It also points to complex interactions between date of birth and the outcome of exposure to given risk factors. Hence, not all of the improvement in the outcome of exposure to health risks between, say, 1970 and 1990 are due to health interventions during that period. Improvements in life expectancy may depend only partly on more effective medical technologies of those years. It could also reflect the improved physiologies experienced by later birth cohorts that are due to improved technologies in food production, public health practices, personal hygiene, diets, and medical intervention put into place decades before 1970, and hence cannot be attributed exclusively, perhaps even primarily, to health inputs between 1970 and 1990. Moreover, many of the health interventions which are effective at late ages today would not be feasible if the physiological capital at late ages was as low today as it was at the beginning of the 20th century. Thank you very much.
I wanted to make sure I understood some numbers you stated early on, and it sounded like in the past century several or many chronic conditions have been delayed by roughly 10 years, while the life expectancy only increased by 6.6 years. I thought that life expectancy increased by significantly more in the past century, but if those are both correct, then is it true that we're living with roughly 3.4 years less of disability despite longer lifespans?
Right. I'm talking about life expectancy at age 50, not at age zero.
I see.
So the increase in life expectancy of life expectancy at age zero is over 30 years. But at age 50, it's 6.6 years. That's exactly what I meant to convey, that a larger part of the lifespan is spent in relatively good health, and we cannot yet rule out that at some future time, maybe in your cohort, everyone will live into old age in good health, and then you all drop dead together.
Thank you.
Professor Fogel, you alluded to the fact that perhaps in the coming period that healthcare costs and so forth might be underestimated because longevities might ultimately exceed what's currently expected. What do you think the sensitivity is in the next 1, 2, 3 decades to current underestimation in financial planning for either healthcare needs or just generally?
Well, the first thing I'd like to do in responding to that question is point out that in 1929, when life expectancy was only about 55 years old in most of the OECD countries, we only spent about 3% of GDP on health care. We were much sicker, we lived shorter lifespan, we only spent 3%. Today we spend 15%, even though across OECD countries, life expectancy is in the neighborhood of 78 years. Poor people live through pain. They can't afford the time. Rich people, if you have a little ache, you say, oh, we better call up the doctor and find out. Maybe he can squeeze us in today. If you're poor, you just go out and work. So as we're getting richer, we spend more and more of our income on health care. It's up to 15%. I published papers predicting that by 2030, it will be over 21%, and I'm on the low side of some of the forecasts are up in the neighborhood of 29%. Part of the reason is, at the beginning of the 20th century, the head of a household spent 75% of their income on food, clothing, and shelter. Today, they spend under 25% of their income on food, clothing, and shelter. And most of what they spend on food, clothing, and shelter isn't on food, clothing, and shelter. It's on services. That is, most of the food is pre-prepared. If I want spinach, I can go to our freezer and get 18 different variety of spinach with lots of different sauces. When my mother went shopping for spinach, the grocer wrapped up a big bundle of spinach in a newspaper that was about a third sand by weight. And she spent all day soaking and pouring out the liquid in which the spinach soaked, and by the time she fed it to me, it was still pretty gritty. So what we spend on food is really a very small part of current income, and that leaves us with a lot of income to spend on services. And entertainment and healthcare are our two favorite services. For some elderly people, their best entertainment is sitting in the waiting room and talking to fellow patients while waiting to see the doctor. So it's a little hard to factor out what's healthcare and what's entertainment. the final point I'd like to make on this is I get distressed every time I hear people complaining about all the money we're spending on health care. What should we spend it on? Why not spend it on health care? I gave a lecture in Dusseldorf a few years ago, and one of the participants came to me and said, I have a Mercedes in my mouth. And I said, what do you mean? And she said, well, with the cost of the work on my teeth, I could have bought a Mercedes. Well, would you rather have a new car or a new knee? At your age, you might want a new car. At my age, new knees are very attractive.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.